I'm here to talk about innovation as a path to saving the world. I know that I am between you and food or drinks or whatever it is you want to do tonight, so I'll try to keep this engaging. I have two important announcements. The first is, if you want to ask questions, you can tweet them to these hashtags, Infinite and South by Southwest, and Brady Forrest up here will watch that, and we'll take questions at the end, and we'll also take questions on the mic around if you think of questions at the end. The other is, this is based on a book that comes out early next year. I'll have a few pop quizzes for you as we go through, and if you answer them right, come up and give me your card, and you'll get a free book when it comes out. Okay? So, first question, who wrote these words? Was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Yes, Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. Well, today it's sort of like A Tale of Two Earths. Are we in the best of all possible situations, or are we kind of on the precipice of disaster? We could be headed for a beautiful science fiction future of living in great wealth and in alignment with nature, or we could be heading for this film. Anybody? Planet of the Apes, thank you very much. Which one happens is up to us. So I'm going to start off by talking about how this is the best of times. I was born in Cairo, Egypt, in a neighborhood a lot like this in 1973. And then I came to the U.S. when I was 3 years old. So hearing about how my parents lived always gave me a great deal of love for the U.S. and a great deal of optimism. It's just hard not to be an optimist when you're so recently from a place where life is so much harder. And indeed, when I was born in Egypt that year, one in seven kids died before they left infancy. And in fact, when my parents were born, it was more like one in four. Five of my mother's siblings died in infancy. Three of my dad's siblings died in infancy. And those numbers were not unusual. That's just what happened. But I came to realize over time that I hadn't just gotten a look at another country, I'd gotten a look back in time. Because it wasn't that long before that the U.S. was the same way. In 1900, a quarter of all kids born in the U.S. died before their fifth birthday. And in big cities like Chicago, a third of all kids died in infancy. Diseases that were endemic in Egypt, like polio and tuberculosis, when I was born, were quite common in the U.S. in those times then. And indeed, things have gotten tremendously better. In Egypt now, infant mortality is 2%. In the U.S., it's less than 1% of children born die in infancy. And in other ways, we can see that we are living the healthiest and longest lives ever. The average life expectancy on the planet has soared in both the rich countries and the world as a whole, from up 20 years in the last 50 years, up from an average around the world of 30 years in 1900 to 67 years today. A child born in China today is likely to live longer than an American born in 1950. And this is one of the best overall measures of kind of human well-being. Poverty has dropped. The fraction of the world that lives on less than a dollar a day, adjusted for inflation, in the 1970s was almost 40%. And today, it's down to 5%. So we've made huge, huge strides. Education has risen everywhere in the world. The average years of schooling for three countries picked here, the U.S., India, and Ethiopia, have all soared. You see this on a log scale that's showing the ratios between them. And the rest of the world is sort of catching up with the rich world. We are more connected than ever before. The cell phone is probably the human invention that has spread the most rapidly. From no penetration at all in 1995 to today, 80 cell phones per 100 people alive on the planet, more than 4 billion cell phones. There are more cell phones in sub-Saharan Africa than there are people alive in North America today. The internet is not far behind. From nothing to 2 billion users. There are more internet users in China than there are people alive in the U.S. and Europe combined. Okay? This is an age of unparalleled connectivity, unparalleled access to information, unparalleled ability to express yourself. And as a consequence of that, and rising wealth and rising education, it's also an age of unparalleled freedom. At the end of World War II, around a quarter of the world's countries were democracies. Today it's nearly 60% and still rising as people are being empowered. So we are living in the age of greatest health, greatest wealth, lowest poverty and hunger, and greatest freedom. But there are also some very dangerous things looming ahead. In 2005, on Christmas Day, I woke up at 4 a.m. I hiked 2 miles through the Guatemalan jungle to get to this structure. This is Temple 4 in the Mayan city of Tikal. And this was the greatest skyscraper in the Western Hemisphere for about 1,000 years. until the 1800s. You climb up and up and up, and we got to watch the sunrise on Christmas Day there, and you feel like you're in Jurassic Park. It's jungle all around you, howler monkeys are roaring, you're in some desolate jungle with just the peaks of these buildings popping up. The building just below the sun is Temple One, which is about a mile away across all this jungle. But it wasn't always like that. In 800 AD, Tikal wasn't jungle. The land around it was all metropolitan. This was a city of 200,000 people inside a civilization of 10 to 20 million people. And then in just a few decades, that civilization crumbled until the ruins were literally these lost temples in the jungle, as it were. And what happened was that their soaring population led them to need more food. To get that, they chopped down all the trees for hundreds of miles around. That led to the soil blowing away. The loss of trees, which capture moisture, worsened droughts that hit the area, until ultimately their most fundamental energy source, their ability to grow food, just couldn't keep up. And that led to increasing strife and a total collapse of this civilization. Well, that's 1,200 years ago. Does it apply now? The most important energy source that we have, the most common, is fossil fuels. And of those, oil is the one that we think about the most. In 1954, a geologist named M. King Hubbert looked at the behavior of individual wells and said individual wells peak in productivity and then plummet once they're kind of depleted and dried up. He put those curves together and predicted that in the U.S. overall, oil production would peak in 1970 and then would plummet. No one believed him. He was laughed at. But he had the last laugh. Oil production in the U.S. did peak in 1970, and that has plummeted since, with a few bumps. But today we produce half as much oil in the U.S. as we did at the peak that Hubbert predicted. Now, the U.S. is not all of the world's oil, obviously, but Hubbert also predicted that we would see worldwide oil production peak between around 2000 and 2005 at somewhere between 70 and 90 million barrels per day. And again, he was laughed at. And for quite a while, oil production around the world climbed and climbed and climbed, then climbed more slowly, and then for the last 8 years, it's been on a plateau. Essentially, despite huge demand from China and other countries that want more oil, the amount of oil we pump out of the ground has been essentially the same for the last 8 years. Now, what we know about oil companies is they are motivated by profit. So with prices sky high, that should motivate them to pump more oil out, but they simply haven't been able to. And in those last 8 years, prices have more than doubled while production has changed by about 4%. And in fact, prices now are about five times the real price after inflation that they were in 1980. So we're having some issues with that. Oil isn't the only resource that's important to us, obviously. Water is life. We use 70% of the water we access to grow food. Without that water, we won't have that much food. Who can name this body of water? This is the Aral Sea between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. And it is, or was, the fourth largest freshwater body in the world, about the size of Lake Michigan. That was 89. Here it is in 2003. And here it is in 2009. It's basically gone. Essentially, Russia redirected the rivers that feed this giant lake to grow cotton, and they did so successfully, but this lake will take hundreds of years to refill, and we emptied it in about 20 years. Now, this is between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. It's really far away, but there are issues closer to home. Can anyone name this body of water? Very good. In the back, you get it. Ogallala Aquifer. This is a giant underground lake under the high plains. This is what we call fossil water because this underground cavern took between 10 and 20,000 years to fill up. This is water left from the end of the last ice age when the glaciers melted. But since 1960, we've pumped about half of it out. And now in northern Texas, the pumps are going dry in many places. And that water is used to irrigate crops. And on current pace, before 2050, it will all be gone. Fish in the ocean. There's lots of fish in the sea, we say, and they are a renewable resource. If you fish them at a sustainable pace, they will grow back. But nowadays, more than 70% of the fish species we depend upon are either crashed or depleting at an incredible rate, and the other 30% are being fished at the maximal rate that they can reproduce. So we are eating up this renewable resource. Forests. In prehistory, two-thirds of the world's land area was covered by forest. Today, it's one-third. Most of that, almost all of that, we chop down to grow food. And perhaps the most serious of all these issues is climate change. Since 1880, temperature has gone up around the world an average of about 2 degrees. It varies, it fluctuates from year to year, but when you look at the overall change, it's quite clear that it has gone up, and this correlates extremely well with the CO2 emissions that we produce from industry. More troubling is that the pace of change is accelerating. The shorter a time span you look back on, the faster warming has been. And in the coming century, we expect warming of anywhere from 6 to 16 degrees Fahrenheit to occur, which is quite a lot. Now, graphs are one thing, but here's some more visceral evidence. This is the Bear Glacier in Alaska in 1920. Here it is in 2005. Okay? This is the Peterson Glacier. This is a mammoth sheet of ice. That's in 1920 also, and here it is in 2005. Look at the mountain outline there, same place, but you couldn't tell if those mountains weren't there to match. Now, this melting glacier does contribute to sea level rise, and over the next century, we expect sea levels to rise 3 to 6 feet. It's not quite the end of the world. The giant statues and skyscrapers won't be underwater, but it will be material for people who live in places like Bangladesh or Miami. But there are more serious issues that aren't a century away that are happening right now. In 2003, Europe was hit by its hottest summer since 1540. Half of Ukraine's wheat harvest failed. 10% of Portugal's forests burned down. In 2009, China was hit by a drought of a severity of 1 in 100 years. In 2010, it was hit by a second drought of a severity 1 in 100 years. That's twice in 100 years. Wells in Yunnan province that gave water continuously for the last 500 years dried up. 20 million people were affected. Now, warmer air has greater moisture capacity. It sucks up moisture, and that can mean drought in one area, and it can mean torrential rainfall in another area. It concentrates the moisture. And indeed, a few months later, Pakistan saw the worst flooding it had ever seen in recorded history. An area twice the size of the state of Texas was underwater in Pakistan. And then later, in August of that year, Russia was hit by its hottest heat wave of all time. In 1 month, in August, 55,000 people died of heat. 11,000 people died of heat that month in Moscow. That's 400 people a day in Moscow dying of heat for a month. And half the Russian wheat crop, which had been forecasted to be the highest wheat crop ever, was gone. Closer to home, last summer, we saw the longest, the driest 10-month stretch recorded here in Texas. The Texas wheat crop was cut in half. The Texas hay crop was basically lost. 10 million acres burned in the U.S. last year. In the 1970s, the average was 1 to 2 million acres of forest burning each year. And this is a direct consequence of heat and drought. Another impact of global warming, or the thing that causes it, is ocean acidification. So CO2 mixes with water to create carbonic acid. Who here likes carbonic acid? Probably a lot of you do. So the thing that makes drinks fizzy, a little carbonic acid is great. In moderation, it's no big deal. But a lot of carbonic acid breaks down calcium. It means that fish in the sea and corals and plankton can't form shells, can't form the corals themselves. And that means that by mid-century, we think we'll have lost more than half of the world's corals. And by the end of the century, we could have lost all of it. So this is the fastest rate of acidification in the oceans in the last 300 million years. The most recent event anywhere like this, 65 million years ago, we can see knocked out 99% of the world's corals. And that is the bottom of the food chain for the ocean. Then there's the problem of the possibility of exponential change. All of that is a linear pace of warming, but warming could set off positive feedback loops. It could set off buried bombs, if you will. This is frozen tundra in Alaska. It was frozen tundra in Alaska a few years ago. Now this is what you call a thaw lake. So the ground beneath it is still frozen, but the surface has melted. And in these thaw lakes, what happens is that organic matter decomposes and becomes methane. Methane is natural gas. It's a potent greenhouse gas. It's actually about 100 times more powerful than CO2 in terms of its warming effect in the first decade, and 30 times more powerful over a century. How do we know this bubble is methane? Well, you can set it on fire, as this scientist, Katie, did. Now, offshore in the Arctic Sea, at the seabed, there is sort of a methane slush, methane hydrates, that are semi-frozen around the rim of Siberia and Canada and Alaska. And there's enough methane that if one-tenth of it went up, the planet would warm by around 10 degrees in one decade. So changes we're talking about taking a century could happen at extremely rapid pace, and that's an almost apocalyptic scenario. We don't know what the odds are of this happening. They might be low, they might be medium, they might be high. We do know that an expedition from Russia a few months ago found mile-wide plumes of methane bubbles rising from the seafloor. So this is clearly starting to destabilize, and we don't really want to push our luck with that. So summing this all up, various groups, like a group called the Footprint Network, estimates that when you look at all the resources we use and the pollution we cause, we're not using one planet's worth of resources, we're using about 1.5 planet's worth of resources. And that if everyone lived like an American, we'd be using about 5 planets' worth of resources. I don't have 4 spare planets. If any of you do, please see me after. We'll work something out. Who can name this city? Shanghai. Good try. Shanghai, 25 years ago, was a little bit more than a fishing village. It was a city, but not a very big city. And now it is a mega city. And this rise of Shanghai mirrors with and is connected to the rise in wealth and prosperity of China. People are living longer in China, they're more comfortable, they have more space, they have cell phones, they have cars, and that's good. But that also means that they're using more steel, more water, emitting more CO2. And so what many environmentalists say now is the problem, the thing that we have to stop, is growth. We have to stop the transformation of fishing villages to mega cities. But this is not realistic. What reasonable expectations are for the next 40 years is that demand for water will go up by half, food by 70%, and energy demand around the world will double. And that increase in demand is not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from China and India and sub-Saharan Africa. And all of those are the places where demand is rising as they rise in wealth and try to catch up with us. Now, who here is a member of the 1%? Who here is part of the global 1%? Everyone raise your hands. You are all part of the global 1%, okay? Even if we could stop the developing world from using more resources, it wouldn't be just, because they are using those resources in an attempt to make their lives better, to have better lives for their kids, bigger homes, the conveniences that we're used to. So we have to find a different way. We have to find a way to let them rise out of poverty while preserving the planet in some way. Now, we've been warned before that growth was about to do us in. Thomas Malthus, the most famous of these predictions in the late 1700s, he wrote that population growth is always exponential, while the growth of any resource, in his case food, is linear. So no matter where you started from, over time, eventually, the exponential would swamp the linear, and you would have a huge crash as the red line overconsumed what the green line can produce. The famines he predicted in the 1800s didn't happen. Paul Ehrlich wrote this book, The Population Bomb, that started with a sentence, "The war to feed humanity is over. Nothing can be done at this late date. Billions will die in the 1970s, which also didn't happen. In 1972, the best-selling environmental book of all time, Limits to Growth, got geeky. They built a computer model that looked at water, energy, pollution, food. And what they found in their model was that economic growth would invariably lead to overconsumption, which would invariably lead to collapse, which they estimated would be in 1992. And that didn't happen. So what did all of these things get wrong? Well, two things. One is that wealth, it turns out, is the ultimate contraceptive. As places around the world get richer, as people get more options, and especially as women get more options, the birth rate falls. It was around 5 kids average per woman lifetime in 1950. Today, it's just over 2. And the only places that are substantially over 2 are the poorest countries in the world. And the best thing we can do to control population is to help those places grow in wealth, because that is proven to work. The other thing that they all missed was the power of innovation to stretch out or maximize or multiply any given resource. Okay? So population has doubled since the population bomb was written, but the amount of food available per person on Earth has gone up by about a third. Total food production has almost tripled while using very little additional land. We've just increased yields by getting smarter. And in fact, that's not a new phenomenon. Over the last 10,000 years, we've increased the productivity of the land by thousands of times. when we were hunter-gatherers, it took an average of around 3,000 acres to feed one person. Today, it takes around 1/3 of 1 acre to feed one person. That's a 10,000 times reduction in a span of 10,000 years. Now, ideas reduce resource use. Some would say, well, modern agriculture is so energy intensive, but it's actually less energy intensive. On modern farms today, we use half as much energy per calorie grown that we did in the 1970s, and about the same for water, about half as much water per calorie grown as we did in the 1970s, as farms have gotten more efficient. What about oil? In America, believe it or not, we use less oil per person per year than ever before, about a third less than the 1970s, and still dropping. Water, which is life. I love this photo of this water droplet. We use today about a third less water per person per year in the U.S. than we did in the 1970s, mostly because agriculture has gotten so much more efficient. Planes use one third as much fuel per passenger mile as they did in the 1970s. The Boeing Dreamliner weighs 20% less than any other plane of its size because it's made more of plastic than metal now. Carbon fiber is plastic, and it's one of those things we invented that did not exist in nature 30 years ago. LEDs produce 500 times as much light per unit of energy than candles do. Steel making in the U.S. uses 1/5 the amount of energy per ton of steel made that it did 80 years ago, and 1/60 as much as it did in the 1800s. So across the board, ideas reduce resource use. Ideas also find substitutes for scarce resources. This is a sperm whale, and we almost drove the sperm whales extinct. In the 1800s, thousands of whaling ships went out hunting sperm whales and killing them, not for their meat, but for the spermaceti in their heads, which could be used to create whale oil, which was the ultimate source of high-quality lighting. We killed off about a third of the sperm whales in a period of about 30 years. And as a result, whale oil production dropped, whale oil prices spiked. Now, what saved the whales wasn't more whaling ships, obviously. It was the invention of a substitute. This man, Abraham Gessner, a Canadian geologist, motivated by the huge demand for high-quality lighting and the business opportunity, invented kerosene. He learned that he could heat up coal, capture the gases, condense it, and he'd have a lighting source that was better than whale oil and that was abundant. Now, we don't know what Gessner thought about the whales. He never wrote anything about the environment. For all we know, he didn't care at all if the sperm whales went extinct or not. But motivated by this huge business opportunity and scientific curiosity, he did a lot to save them, ultimately. Or this plot of land. This is one of the Chinches Islands off the coast of Peru. And in 1850, acre per acre, this was quite possibly the most expensive and most valuable real estate in the world. Okay? Why? Well, the birds. Actually, not quite the birds, the bird shit. For millions of years, birds have been nesting on these islands and leaving behind guano. And guano is rich in nitrogen. It's an amazingly effective fertilizer. And so in the mid-1800s, people in Europe and the U.S., farmers bought bagged up guano shipped from these islands, mined by slaves, to apply to their fields. And without this addition of guano, American and European agriculture could not have kept up with the demands of population. We would have had famines in those places. This was so important to us, in fact, that President Fillmore, in his 1850 State of the Union address, described these islands as being a key American interest. The sort of language that an American president today might use about Saudi Arabia, for instance. And they were so tempting that in 1864, Spain sent its new ironclad warship at the head of a small fleet to seize these islands. Peru fought back, Chile and Panama joined Peru's side, a war was fought, the U.S. almost went to war with Spain, and in the end, Peru kept possession of these islands. But 10 years later, the guano was gone. It was a finite supply. Peak guano had come and gone. So we shifted. The Peruvians discovered that Charles Darwin had visited this place, the Tarapacá Desert, and written in his journals about how the locals used saltpeter to fertilize the fields. So now the Tarapacá Desert became the premier source of fertilizer around the world. So premier that Chile invaded its neighbor Peru to seize it, and Chile became the Saudi Arabia fertilizer. And then within 20 years, people started to worry that even this was running out. And the incoming president of the British Scientific Association said that we had this epic problem, that Europe and America were in a grave crisis because of the end of this fertilizer supply. Well, two men rose to the challenge. Haber on the right and Bosch on the left. Haber was an academic and motivated by curiosity and glory. He invented a way to suck nitrogen out of the air, worth 78% of the atmosphere, and make ammonia in small quantities. And Bosch, employed by BASF that saw a huge market, worked to scale that up to epic size. And the two won the Nobel Prize. And now this process uses about 1% of the energy that humanity has access to each year and roughly doubles the amount of food that we can produce. So ideas find substitutes for resources time and again. They also transform waste into value. This is a landfill mining operation in Germany. Landfill mining is an exploding industry. Why? Well, the Japanese estimate that the amount of gold in landfills in Japan exceeds 10 years of gold mine production around the world. They believe that the amount of rare earths from discarded electronics in Japanese landfills alone is around 10 years what Japanese industry uses to make new electronics. Alcoa estimates there's about a 15-year supply of aluminum in the world's landfills. Now, it's undoubtedly more efficient to choose to recycle something ahead of time and to separate it than it is to just dump it out. But even when something is dumped out now, increasingly, if there is value, whatever that is, that got dumped, someone will find a way to mine that, extract it, and turn it back into value. So ideas reduce resource use, they find substitutes for resources, they transform waste into value. So what does that mean about the limits to growth? What are the limits to growth on this planet, really? Is there a population limit? There probably is. There's only so much room. But with the trends in fertility, it looks like we'll never get close to that. It looks today like population around the world will peak at around 9 or 10 billion people before starting to drop. And we can feed that many. And we can provide energy for that many, as we'll see. A physical resource limit? Undoubtedly. Physical resources are, in fact, finite. But let's think about the size. This drop of oil represents all the fossil fuels that humanity uses in a year. And it's a very, very, very large drop of oil. But it actually pales in comparison to a much larger, much more abundant source of energy all around us, which is the light coming in from the sun, which in any given year provides the Earth about 10,000 times more energy than we use from all fossil fuels and from hydro and nuclear, all combined. Okay? To give you a sense of scale, 10 seconds of sunlight striking the top of the atmosphere has the same amount of energy as all of humanity will use from all sources in one day. 1 hour of sunlight at the top of the atmosphere is the same energy content as 1 year of human energy utilization from all sources combined. These yellow dots represent the amount of space you would need to use around the world with current efficiency solar technology to capture enough energy to meet all of humanity's energy needs in 2050. It's both a large amount and a very small amount of land at the same time. Certainly it pales compared to the amount of land we've converted for other use, like agriculture. Now the problem has been cost. Solar photovoltaics are traditionally made like computer chips on silicon wafers that are etched by various high-temperature processes, and that makes them expensive. But like computer chips, solar power has an exponential price reduction. In 1980, it cost $20 per watt of solar power, and today we're down to it costing about $1 per watt of solar power. And that, if anything, that trend is accelerating. Today, in Southern California and perhaps in parts of Texas, we're on the verge of solar being price competitive with coal and natural gas without subsidies or tax breaks. And over the next decade, as solar drops in price by another factor of two or so, that will spread across the rest of the country and most of the world. So we're on the verge of that. Now, unfortunately, we don't only use energy when the sun is shining. We use energy at night to power our cities and factories, for instance. That means we have to store energy as well as capture it. And storage, up until now, has been a challenge. We have to do it for the cities, we have to do it for transportation. And today, we don't have solutions that are really up to snuff for what we want to do. But there's reasons for hope. Lithium-ion batteries made incredible gains in getting cheaper and denser, meaning more energy per size of battery, over the last 20 years. Between 1990 and 2005, the price of lithium-ion batteries dropped by a factor of 10. And the density, the amount of energy you can store in a lithium-ion battery per unit weight, doubled. And that was driven by competition in laptops and music players and cell phones. And now a lot of it's being driven by electric cars and grid storage. Okay? if we can crack energy, we can crack almost everything else. 99% of the water, the liquid water on the planet, isn't fresh, it's salt water, like here in the Sea of Japan. And originally, turning salt water into fresh was extremely energy intensive. You had to boil the water, catch the steam, and condense it. But over the last few decades, there have been advances in mimicking something that cells do, biological cells, which is they have membranes that let some things through and not others. So reverse osmosis desalination that mimics these biomembranes has dropped the amount of energy that you need to use by a factor of 10. And today, in the Middle East, for instance, desalination plants sell desalinated water at a fifth of a penny per gallon. So we're at the point, or just on the edge of the point, where desalination actually can provide the bulk of the world's water needs. Food, I talked about how we've increased the amount of food that we can grow, but there's tremendous headroom. What we know is that the limit of photosynthesis could make, if we got there, our farms could produce 40 times as much food as they do today in the U.S. And if we all ate vegetarian, the ratio would be even better. But even without that, with 10 billion people eating American-style diets, if farms were as efficient as is theoretically possible, we could use about one-tenth the amount of farmland that we have today to feed them. What would we do with the rest? Maybe we turn it back into forest. Maybe it would become parks. That would be up to us. Now, is it possible for us to do that? Let me point out just one thing in the works that has some hopes. Corn, wheat. We think of them as fairly similar, right? But corn grows nearly twice as much grain per acre as wheat does. Why? Corn has a newer version of the genes for photosynthesis, the ability to capture light from the sun and turn it into sugar. It's something called C4 photosynthesis that's only 30 million years old. It's a relative newcomer. And now, researchers at universities and nonprofits, funded in part by the Gates Foundation, are working on isolating those genes and porting them into crops like wheat and rice. And that alone could nearly double the yields of those crops. Other researchers are working on ways to allow grains to capture nitrogen from the air, removing the need for fertilizer, or at least dramatically reducing it. So the upside is huge. So yes, physical limits absolutely exist, but they are extremely, extremely distant from where we are today. In every area, they're at least an order of magnitude beyond where we are, and in some areas, they're 100 times or 1,000 times what we're looking at today. But there's one more idea I want to get across here, which is, what is the limit to wealth? Because does greater wealth have to mean greater use of material resources? It doesn't look that way. So what's happened over the last 40 years across the world is that wealth has risen far faster than has energy use or pollution. So this is around the world. Per person GDP is the green line, and it's doubled since 1970. Whereas CO2 emissions and energy use have gone up by about 10 and 20% per person, respectively. And in fact, in the U.S., even after we look at the things we import from China and elsewhere, it's even more clear than that. It's almost flat for per capita CO2 emissions and per capita energy, while wealth has gone up. Now, this may seem deeply counterintuitive. How can this happen? So I'll ask you to consider one example. Consider ENIAC, the first digital computer on the right, versus an iPhone that might be in your pocket on the left. The iPhone uses a million times less material, a million times less energy, and computes a million times more while taking pictures, playing music, you know, checking you into Foursquare, whatever it is you want to do. How can this be? And if you melted down that iPhone, you've got a few cents worth of resources. If you add all the labor and all the energy and all the factories, maybe it's worth a few tens of dollars. It's not worth the hundreds of millions that went into ENIAC, right? What you hold in your hand, when you've got an iPhone, like this fellow here taking a photo, what you're holding is concentrated knowledge, embodied knowledge. You're holding, wow, two of them. You're, yeah, yeah. It looks the same from here. What you've got is you've got Marconi's discovery of radio. You've got the laws of electromagnetism. You've got Turing's discoveries of computing, modified or condensed, instantiated in matter. And that's what gives them the value. And knowledge, unlike any other resource, isn't depleted by usage. Everything else kind of gets worn down a little bit or used up, right? Knowledge, not so much. It replicates, it spreads to other minds, and it accumulates over time. So it is literally the natural resource that we always have more of today than we had yesterday, which makes it unlike anything else. So there's no practical limit that we can see on the growth of our wealth. So with that, I think we should all go have a drink. Nope, sorry. That does not mean that the problem is solved. There's a difference between knowing what the theoretical limit is and what actually has to happen between now and then, and will we get there in time. And the situation we're in is we're in a race. We're in a race between our rate of consumption of natural resources and our innovation in stretching those resources out. And no one knows which will win, actually. There are some big challenges. One of them, I'll say, is scale. So just use energy as an example. Those yellow dots are a small fraction of the land we have available, but they're very large in physical terms. This is about 1/20th of the 10-megawatt solar array at Nellis Air Force Base in California. And to power the planet entirely off solar, we would need about 8 million of those arrays, of which we're seeing 1/20th. So 160 million times this is what we'd have to build. Okay, that's substantial. And even taking into account the exponential decline in solar prices, you're looking at about $50 trillion to get this done by 2050. Now, that's only about 0.5% of the world's GDP. It's well within humanity's capabilities, but it's still a staggeringly large amount of money. And it will take a lot to motivate this to happen. So we're not out of the woods. The other challenge, the even bigger challenge, really, is cases of market failure. This is the Cuyahoga River. It flows through Cleveland. It's a lovely place, but it wasn't always so. In the late 1960s, you could stick your hand in, and it would come out covered with oil and gunk. And the problem is, this river was a commons. Anyone could pollute it at no cost. And the river was lined with businesses and factories that just dumped their oil, dumped their waste into the river. And in fact, if they didn't, let's say this factory had been a good citizen and hadn't done that, and the factory next door did, well, this guy's probably paying higher costs if they're not polluting. So they have to deal with that. And now the factory next door is getting more customers and drives them out of business. So the market, which is a brilliant innovation, selects for pollution of the commons. Now, inevitably, this killed all the fish in this river and did a lot more damage. But it really caught the public's eye in 1969 when a passing rail car on a bridge threw a spark down to the river, and it lit the river on fire. The layer of oil on top of it went up. This was the 13th time the river had caught on fire since the 1800s. But in the age of color television and Time magazine, you know, pre-tweets, but definitely more media, this caught the country's attention for the first time. The last time it had happened had been just after World War II. We had other things in our minds. The time before that, television hadn't been widespread. Every case, every significant case of environmental degradation in the world is a case of the commons. There is almost no other situation in which environments get degraded. When it's a freshwater lake between two countries that no one owns, when it's forests that no one owns, when it's fish in the sea that are outside of any national jurisdiction, when it's pollution to the air that everyone owns or that no one owns, when it's the warming up of our planet, all of it comes down to a problem of the tragedy of the commons. Okay? Now, fortunately, we have gotten better. We've innovated in our systems for managing this. This is the Cuyahoga River today. It looks quite different than it looked in 1969. And that happened in large part because that fire prompted the creation of the EPA in 1970, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act in the next 3 years, signed into law by this man, believe it or not, Richard Nixon. Here's another case of the commons, and this one was probably worse, far worse even than climate change. This would have killed us all. In the 1970s, we learned that the ozone layer was thinning. We all know about the ozone hole, but the ozone layer everywhere, really, was thinning. And without that, basically, ultimately, all life on Earth would come to an end, pretty much. Now, it's stabilized, and this is what NASA believes it will look like in 2028. Not quite completely healed, but very, very close to that. That's happened because we got together, more than 100 nations, and signed something called the Montreal Protocol that regulated the release of CFCs and other ozone-depleting substances. And that led to an incredible reduction in the release of these things. When this was enacted, people said, oh, you can't do it. All cooling refrigeration for drugs will cease because we just don't have any other way to refrigerate. But within 2 years, we had replacements for everything, and the total amounts had plummeted. The person who signed the Montreal Protocol, by the way, Ronald Reagan, possibly because he was a skin cancer survivor, and you had a little bit of an intuitive understanding of what less UV protection might mean for the world. Or consider this one, acid rain. Sulfur dioxide is released from coal-burning power plants. It mixes with water to create sulfurous acid. Sulfurous acid comes down on trees and does this to them, comes down on lakes. And here we innovated. We created a new model, which is called cap and trade, which is, we said to factories, there's a total amount of sulfur dioxide you can emit, and each year that amount will go down. Now, you can trade or buy or sell those from others. If you're having a hard time making the modifications for your plant, somebody else has lower hanging fruit, you can work out a way to make that happen. And that meant that government picked the target, picked the goal and the outcome, but the market did its magic for finding the most efficient way to achieve it. And this was a radical idea. Environmentalists hated it, and people on the right hated it also, for different reasons, obviously. John Sununu, who was chief of staff at the time, said this would end the U.S. economy. People in the Sierra Club said this was a license to commit murder. But what's happened is that we've actually stopped acid rain, and a lot of it was because George Bush Sr., was willing to overrule his political allies and his chief of staff to make it happen. In every case, the cost of limiting these sorts of negative emissions has been far lower than expected, and that's most true in the case of cap and trade, where we let the market figure out the outcomes. Now, today, the big pollutant we have to worry about is the release of greenhouse gases. And so it's time to put a price on those, either through a cap-and-trade system or a carbon tax. Now, people worry that this will be a much larger amount of money than any previous thing that we've tackled, and that that will have a big negative effect on the economy. So there is another new innovation that is well worth utilizing here, which is making this revenue neutral. So what does that mean? So here's how a carbon price would work. Polluters have to pay for every ton of CO2 or other greenhouse gases they produce. That goes into a trust. Now, because a solar company doesn't produce CO2, their product becomes relatively cheaper than coal, which gives an advantage to people buying solar. But if all this money is just lost from the economy, it is a potential cause of a recession and so on. So the trust then takes all that money and distributes it evenly to every person in the country, independent of how much greenhouse gas you are responsible for. So if you used less than the average amount of greenhouse gas emissions because you chose solar, or you live a more efficient lifestyle, or you live in a place where power is hydro, you come out ahead. If you burn more, you end up paying more in buying your energy than you get back in your tax break or tax refund. Now, the whole point here, really, is to shift the scales in cost so that when you're going to buy energy or thinking about investing in efficiency, efficiency and solar and wind are all more attractive on a relative scale than are coal and natural gas. And we've seen that this works. British Columbia, just north of my home in Seattle, enacted a carbon tax that's revenue neutral in 2008. And what's happened is they give all the money back in tax breaks. And while people said this would hurt British Columbia's economy, they have the lowest unemployment of any province in Canada, and they've seen higher income growth and GDP growth than the rest of Canada. Sweden enacted one back in the early 90s, and they have actually seen their overall, not even per capita, overall greenhouse emissions drop by about 20%, while their GDP has grown a little bit faster than Europe's overall. So there's every evidence that doing this can have the effect that we want on greenhouse gases while returning money to the economy and keeping it growing. So there is no conflict, if we do it right, between being green and having growth. So what can all of us do? Three things. First, we have to communicate. The EPA and the Clean Water Act came into existence because the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. Public awareness is what created the political conditions that allowed us to get this to happen. So we have to keep communicating, and especially to people across the aisle. It is going to be not in the Democratic Party that most of this change has to happen. It's going to be largely among independents and people who are moderate Republicans. Those are the groups that have to switch over, and those are the people it's important to talk to. It's easy to shy away from this issue because it gets so emotional, but it's worth doing and doing calmly. Talk to your family, your friends, your coworkers. The second is participate. At the national level, call your congressman, call your senator, leave a message saying what you support. At a state level, half of all states have renewable energy portfolio standards that mandate some amount of solar or wind. Encourage that. Call your state reps. Call your governor and thank them for that. In fact, Texas does even. And even at a local level, cities increasingly have things going on there. And then keep hope. We have solved problems like this before. This will probably be the largest one, but others were even more dangerous. The ozone layer really could have killed us all, and we ultimately did the right thing and did the smart thing and made the right choices there. So ideas, innovation, are the ultimate source of growth, the ultimate source of wealth. And if we make the right choices, if we innovate both in technology and in our systems for managing our planet, we can have our cake and eat it too. We can grow the wealth of 10 billion people on this planet while reducing our impact on the world. So Thank you very much. I hope you all watch for the book. Come see me if you won one. And please tweet any questions to Infinite South by Southwest, or we'll take some verbally as well. All right?
From Ryan Stewart on Twitter, is it just for the U.S. to enact a child limitation policy?
A child limitation policy. So the U.S., is it just for the U.S.? Like, who asked the question? Are you in here? What, can you elaborate on that?
Okay, well, what I mean is if we're talking about resource consumption and...
Okay, well, if we're talking about resource consumption and in the fact that... more people cause more of a need for the grain belts. It means the more the water and for instance, I go to Texas State. I'm a grad student, and not too long we love our river, the San Marcos River, Blanco River. We love it. That's it's a part of Texas State. And a couple of years ago, there was a big situation where they were talking about diverting, because you know Edwards Aquifer comes in right there, and they were talking about diverting the San Marcos to San Antonio, but San Antonio needed the water. And so why I ask is the idea of child limitations, because in some urban cities the populations are great, and then we have to care for more. So I'm wondering, as a country, as you see with China, it is a necessary thing to have a child limit because their population rates are soaring. If ever it got to the point as a planet, because the population is growing every year, or it goes up, would it be just if it ever became a consideration? Would setting a child limit, meaning you know two children or more, or just something to that nature, do you think that'd be something worth considering if it became a stress on our natural resources?
I think if we were in the situation of the 1960s, where population growth was rising and each year added more kids than the last, it might be something you had to look at. But in reality, it's very, very, very hard to do it in an ethical and just way. It causes all sorts of problems in China. And it doesn't seem like we need it, because population growth is dropping everywhere. Most of Europe is kind of neutral to population negative. Japan's workforce has been shrinking for 5 years. China's workforce starts shrinking this year. And that's actually kind of bad news for China. And even in the U.S., we are at just barely above replacement rate. Actually, the U.S. and India are the only two industrial powers that really have growing populations at this point. So we'll get there. Thanks.
Given that the EPA started out as somewhat of at least a Republican initiative, what do you think led to the case today where so many of the current candidates are calling for it to be shut down? What do you think started that trend?
I wish I knew. I think it's about other things. I mean, Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney both were on record in the past as supporting a carbon tax or cap and trade of some sort. Newt Gingrich used to campaign for it in between his political stint and this one. So I think it's mostly a cynical attempt to poke holes at the current administration. To win a race, they have to say, here's what's bad about the current administration. And I think it's playing to the base during the primary season as well. My guess is if Romney won, he would actually be much more moderate on the environment than he plays in the primaries. But we'll see if that happens.
I wonder... Because you talked about that we do not produce as much resources as we actually could if we used innovative ways for it. I wonder, are we innovating too slowly? Are we implementing innovations too slowly? I don't want to say whose fault is it, mm-hmm. but who's responsible? Is it? Do you see responsibility more on the side of politics, more on the side of media, more on the side of corporations, or is it just all of us?
There are certainly ways that we could be innovating faster. So the U.S. budget in energy R&D, for instance, the federal budget, is about a third of what it was in real dollars in the 1980s. We produce half, as a percentage of our college graduates, half as many have degrees in science and engineering as they did in 1990. So there are ways in which we're not kind of producing the people or funding the people who are going to do most of that innovation. So I think that's one of the biggest issues. And then the other is, until a commons becomes depleted, unless there's a price on it, you have less reason to want to innovate. So if there was a price on taking water out of the Ogallala Aquifer, you can bet there would be more money going into desalination or increasing the efficiency of water use on farms in that area.
You talked about like the lithium battery solution. Well, talked about that. What's the sustainability of, so if everyone had electric cars and that sort of thing?
It looks like sustainability is ultimately pretty high. So we always look at things and say, here's an issue with the coming technology. So I'll give you an example. One of the things people would say is an issue with solar is that solar cells often use rare earth elements, and there's only a finite amount of those in the planet. Okay? But over the last few years, there have been an incredible number of new scientific papers showing ways to either cut the amount of rare earth elements they need by a dramatic amount or replace them entirely. Now you can make solar cells out of carbon nanotubes or thin films that don't use any. So we don't know where the true limits are, but just in the basis of the amount of total amount of energy available, total amount of minerals available on the planet, total amount of food we could raise, total amount of water, all of those look like we could sustainably support a population of 10 billion people with a richer than American lifestyle, again, if we had made the right choices and had the right level of efficiency in our technologies. Which doesn't mean that we're sustainable today. We're not. But it's more about how inefficiently we use the resources than the actual limit of the resources.
I was thinking with the idea of the phrase of going green, and when it comes to the public side of that fact, I think a lot some things get muddled when the fact when people talk about you know the reason people don't say global warming anymore is kind of it's a trap word because the planet naturally cools and heats itself. So like what I asked, do you think the message is effectively sent across, because you know, like one of the biggest, like a huge CO2 producer on our planet is the oceans. It's part of the process of water evaporating. Do you think the message is coming off across, especially as we know with politics, things can get very muddled due to people's egos. Do you think the message of everything that's going on, or the things that go on, do you think it effectively gives across to people, or do you feel there's some bias in there?
There's a lot of intentional efforts to obfuscate, and they're not unprecedented. So during the debate about CFCs, Dow, for a long time, funded a campaign to convince people that CFCs were not depleting the ozone layer. And to their credit, they eventually turned that around and said, you know what, actually, we were wrong. It really is happening, and we have to do something about it. That happened once Freon came off patent. It happened to be a convenient correlation between those events. And that happens today. But people don't actually make their decisions based on cold, hard facts very often. They make their decisions based off what other people tell them, who they care about. There's a lot of data that shows that people will decide if a speaker is right or wrong on a topic by their political affiliation and not by what they're saying. That can sway perception by 20 points or more on a 100-point scale. They also make decisions off of what they see and experience viscerally. So if you go to Alaska, there's a lot more belief in climate change among Republicans in Alaska than there is among Republicans in Texas, because it's just hard to deny what's actually happening. So I think that as more people either see consequences themselves directly, or in Cleveland, the Cuyahoga River, you could not live in Cleveland in 1970 and not believe there was a problem with the river. Like it wasn't a graph, it wasn't a stat, it was like, oh my God, it caught on fire. So I think a lot of that is what's going to actually make action feasible. I think two things. People getting more convinced, largely a result of actual events that seem pretty catastrophic, they can point their finger at, and two is the dropping cost of actually fixing things as technology brings those prices down. Ryan, over here, sorry.
I work for an environmental nonprofit that works on clean energy, and definitely buy your central argument that technology is changing rapidly and that there could be a potential solution here. I also see, and I thought you did a great job at showing that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And so what is your personal opinion? Are we going to be able to make it? Do you think that after doing all this research and kind of crunching all the numbers that we're going to be old men sitting on the porch? And are we going to be looking at a devastated world, or is it going to be a world of abundance?
I am an optimist. I'm wired that way, but I'm aware of my bias. I think the most realistic thing is that we will prevail, but not without scars. We'll lose more species, we'll cause more problems, it will take a long time to overcome. It will be another few decades before we've totally fixed the ozone hole. And so we'll be leaving behind problems that are far more expensive to fix than they would have been to head off, and some of them will be nearly unfixable, because when you lose a species, it's very hard to bring that data back. but that we'll probably come out of it okay. Because the other effect is that the worse things get, the more motivated people get for action. So that's kind of self-correcting. Get the mic. Okay.
So we spoke a lot about solar energy, or you spoke a lot about solar energy.
Yes. So the question is wind and solar, and is wind wasted? Absolutely not. So I only so much time, unfortunately, but wind is doing great. Wind energy in lots of parts of the country is competitive with coal already, and wind is cheaper than solar in places that are windy. The reality is we'll always have some mix. In Seattle, where I'm from, the electricity is almost all hydro. There's no reason to rip out the hydro and put in solar. So we'll always have some mix of different energy sources, and there will be places where wind makes a lot of sense for a long time. And wind ultimately is actually solar energy. It's solar energy. Some of that 10,000 times what we use gets turned into heat that moves the air around. The reason that I pick on solar mostly is because it has a much steeper price decline. So it will cross wind by the end of this decade, it looks like. And there's a lot more area in the world where you can tap into solar well. And the ultimate amount of energy you can get from direct solar is going to be much higher than wind. So I think wind will keep growing. Wind is now 1% of the U.S. energy supply, maybe 1.5%. And it'll go up and up and up for a while. But I think solar will pass it sometime towards the end of this decade. There's just more energy actually hits the ground as photons than gets turned into wind. So there's just more of it to tap into. And it's a little bit more predictable, too. There's two in front of you here.
Hey, not sure if I'm going to frame this quite right, but I'm curious what role you think soft and digital goods, particularly software, will have to play in kind of a way out at providing, you know, our apparent like consumption and economic growth needs, while also reducing resource usage.
I think it's a great question. Part of the reason, so in the U.S., the decoupling between wealth and energy use is even more clear. Again, even when after you factor in everything we import from China and all the factories it took to make it, in the U.S. it's like absolutely clear. CO2 per capita is basically flat. Energy per capita is basically flat. Oil per capita is going down while wealth has risen sharply. And a lot of that's because increasingly a lot of the wealth and the value in our lives comes from things that are not hard goods. And some of it's services, some of it's entertainment, you know, movies, books, and certainly things online. And things like working from home, facilitated by software, definitely have an impact on reducing energy use, for instance. So I think they do play a key role. Okay. If that's it, thank you all very much. If you want a book, come tell me, and you'll get it in a few months.